I can tell you what overdoing it does. I told you about this advertising consultant who sent out 100 books when they were published all over Hell's Half Acre. And I know the fate of a couple of them because we worked on one account together in Dallas. I see one book sitting passively in the office of the old chairman of the board, and as far as I know, it's never been opened because he's a Catholic convert. I know of another book that ricocheted and may do some good. I don't know. I've lost track of it. But I know one of the executives was quite incensed that my friend sent him this blue book. Some darn fool thing about, I don't know, he says it's a way out there thing. And then later on he said he asked me for $10 for it, which dates it because the price has been $12 for one. Now the net effect of sending the blue book to this chap is resentment.
I have had that feeling all along that it needs the proper approach.
All right. I'm not going to send this to Gainesville, Georgia until I'm sure of my ground. When I was sure of my ground in Darien, I boldly sent it to my two best friends in Darien. And don't think it didn't stress our friendship. We've had many a discussion with laughter. Old Sandy and one of his buddies says, you know, we think Willie has probably flipped his wig. Let's talk to him in low, modulated, pear-shaped tones when he gets down here next, see? Let's not excite him. But it was strong enough, it took the stress.
Well, it's hard to somebody just cold to pick up this book and appreciate it. They just can't do it. And that is where the need for study and thought on the proper approach to the person you may be contemplating introducing it to.
Mm-hmm. But there's no set rule.
No,
everyone you can work with.
Everyone will be an individual situation. But I have a nephew in the chaplain of the Army that I would just love to get him to read that part four. He's a student of the Baptist Seminary in Fort Worth, but, I mean a graduate, but I still think he's young enough and not set in his ways and beliefs. I think it would be very impressive to him. I don't think he could read it and not go back and pick it up. It would be a challenge.
What would
they think? I would say why.
I
know. They probably just feel sorry for me.
Well, have you ever thought of just sending him part four?
Yes. I've thought of it, but I haven't done anything about it.
Have you got a four-volume edition? Why don't you try it sometime?
He studies all the time anyway, and he has a good basis for part four, is what I was thinking. And his opportunity is so great with his connection, his contact, that I just think this would be more.
The only frustration I experience, Bill, in that line is this. I know there are any number of people who are hungry and don't know about this book.
They have a hidden hunger.
Yeah.
And people who are hungry and don't know they're
hungry. This is also true.
Yes.
How do we find them?
There's the problem.
I have a feeling that out of how many people in this country? 165 million?
Roughly. 185.
Huh?
180 now.
180?
185, according to.
Well?
Time.
Then 18 million would be 10%. 1,800,000 would be 1%. 900,000 would be a half of 1%. Approximately a half a million, that'd be a quarter of one. I bet you there's a half a million people in this country that are hungry for this book.
Well,
Four is more than that.
That's a quarter of 1% of the total. I don't think we're that unique.
I think that's very conservative.
Mm-hmm. I meant to be conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you say a quarter of 1% is a 500,000 people, that's a hell of a low percentage. And yet a heck of a lot of people. And this doesn't frustrate me. I'm just kind of bothered a little about how could you bring buyer and seller together? I'd like to be a better broker, you know.
Well, that's what I was thinking, and that's the reason I was thinking of this one particular boy would have a much greater opportunity to present it than just say my next door neighbor.
Yeah, sure.
What I mean.
Many of you are going to have the same problem we have. He's got to find
That's right, but
yes.
He's in that place, he's in that condition.
Where those that are hungry may come to him.
Well, sure.
But Bill, he's not going to have the problem. For this reason, he's dealing with younger people. It's much easier to find younger people. Younger people are hunting facts.
Yeah.
And if you can furnish them something that supplies facts, now, I've got a contact now. I haven't met him. But he was going down immediately. Lost his contact. And buy one of these books. I don't know if he's bought it yet. But he's looking for facts. He's got an adventurous mind. He's had a little talk with a fella that I did quite a talk to, see, that didn't exactly take it, almost, but it didn't, see. But he related to this fella, and this
yeah.
fella picked it up. Now, he's a lot better subject than the one I talked to, see. But when you go to older people that are established in some kind of a religion or church in their secularistic way, you don't make much progress. But the young mind is looking for facts. You can build a picture that intrigues him there, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I think this chaplain that you're talking about, dealing with young people, has got a lot better chance than somebody, minister of a church, that you're dealing with older people.
Yes, and usually those boys who... some of them maybe for the first time are beginning to think about
mm-hmm.
because they're getting his unit's getting combat ready now, and they're beginning to think about the seriousness of life and death and so forth, and are sort of might be sort of right to be.
I don't think young Johnny thought much about what came after this life until suddenly he realizes that within 12 months his dad is going to be exploring if he's qualified to get started that soon. This makes it very real.
Yeah.
Well, there are two extremes. We'll proclaim it over the radio. That's one extreme. And the other one is... I've heard about it. And the other one is we will sit quietly and perspire spiritually and let our aroma attract the multitudes.
Well, I'll run out of air and a damn I'm going to buy any dynamite.
Yeah.
But the pond, so.
I think trolling and casting.
Well, is that legit?
Sure it is.
Someone that ostensibly satisfied?
Well, you can test them. I don't want to disturb anybody that's happy in his religion. I don't want it on my conscience in the event I take something away from him that's working and fail to supply it. I think our prospects are the people that are not happy in their religion. They're looking for something. They're conscious of hunger. These are prospects. The other folks are just suspects. And that's a fundamental of salesmanship. If the guy is not conscious of a need, he's not in the market. Now, if he's conscious of the need, state your proposition, show the benefits, prove them, and ask for the order. That's selling, in a nutshell. It's a little hard to put it into effect now and then.
Well, I think you're looking right straight across the table.
Well, on the other hand, you've got Jesus' one qualification. If we have a chance to live with this person and intrigue them with what we have. No, in this case, you've got a friendship of your standing, which gives you an access channel that you often don't have.
Well, I kind of disagree with your statement, too.
You mean Goodman said it wrong again?
Just
as normal as ever. Let's get her.
By the time I wipe the saliva off my left foot, my right one is wet.
I tell you, we'll get her in private and beat the hell out of her someday.
I tell you, one thing we don't do is say, we don't say yes, sir, to everything everybody else says. We if we don't have disagreements, there's something abnormal.
Lord help us when we stop thinking for ourselves. This is real bad, then.
I think it's awful nice that we don't agree on every issue, too. Life would become extremely dull on Wednesday night.
We want unity, not uniform.
That's right.
Well, I'm not ready to go out and die to my
spawn. But I'll tell you that trolling and casting, there's many and many a day that I never get a bite.
We'll
try.
And I mean that day.
You can do both.
Minnie Mae's going to have you some better bait. She's raised them by the ton.
I think you should troll.
Right.
Get more bait.
Absolutely.
Trolling is a continuous operation. Mm-hmm. I'm always trolling.
Casting.
No, it's just in the last month. I've decided to do some casting in this Gainesville group. And I may be a year or 18 months developing that prospect. It's time consuming. Well, I like those people and I think they like me. And there's a climate. There I think is a good climate. I'm going to test it farther. And the only way I can test it is go be with them.
That's right. And like you said, we'll go about action. That's what we ought to do. Just anything, so it's action.
I'm conscious of this now as a project.
And I think each one of us should work out and start thinking about a project.
Yeah. Well, I periodically go to Atlanta. I periodically go to Florida. Now, I've often done these two together. I'm going to separate them now, see? This will double my incidence of visits to the Southeast. And it'll give me more weekends in Gainesville.
Where is Gainesville?
It's just a little northeast of Atlanta. You know that northeast slant of the railroads as they follow the Blue Ridge?
I've been there, but I've forgotten where.
Well, Gainesville is on the way up to Anderson, Gainesville. Then you hit Spartanburg, Greenville, Charlotte. And you're often running in that. It's the way the railroads run. It's a little hick town in Georgia. It was a surprisingly decent square because it got cleaned out by a tornado and WPA helped them rebuild their square.
Mm-hmm. Gainesville, Georgia. What is it,
30. Of all the places to contemplate.
Relatively.
To contemplate a blue book sale. Well, I get the general manager of the Daily Times, the editor. There's my folks I know, and I like it. They're just awful nice people. The publisher's wife is very orthodox. The editor's wife is extremely orthodox. No, I mean the general manager's wife is extremely orthodox. but neither the publisher nor the general manager are. And the editor's wife isn't.
Six involved, but no couple.
The couples are all...
couple together.
Heterogeneous, you know. That's three out of six I can work on. I don't know the editor too well. I know him the least well of the six. He's always putting the paper to bed and gets to the party late. And they're none of them blue nose. They'll all take a drink. And this publisher, J.B., collects trees and shrubs. He's got a kind of an estate there. I guess it's big enough to have an estate. They got horses there. And he's all the time getting different kinds of trees and shrubs and collecting them. It's an interesting hobby.
We had a fellow here one time. He had 40 acres out there.
Why don't we turn it off?
And he,
yeah, I did.
He shipped in, he wanted a bra.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yes, sir. What's that with Jimmy?
Well, in last week's class, we decided that there was a distinct line of demarcation between bronchial and spiritual. But now, where do you cross the balance meridian between bronchism and spirituality?
Between what?
Bronchism and spirituality.
It's the last step before you leave the local universe.
The local universe?
Yeah.
I thought it was around, either on the architectural sphere, the training world, it says in there, in quote, you're now becoming, or you are, more spiritual and broader.
Yeah.
In other words, I'm trying to reach the point where you're 51% spiritual and 49%
all right,
broad.
Here. There's 570 steps in the Marantra career.
Right.
Look, divide them by 2. That gives you 285 steps would be halfway.
Mm-hmm.
When you take the 286th step, you're over the hump.
Well, then we just have to find the 286th step.
Yeah, yeah. I think that would be a fair speculation. Now, I think the first step and the last step are very slight departures from what you were. I think on the first mansion world, we are going to be satisfyingly tangible. We're going to have a feeling for a grip. We can break a leg. I think, at least they say we're subject to material accidents. I think we could get laid up if we got a little bit silly driving over the holidays. And I think there are hospitals on the first mansion world where they have to do repair work on people. Now, I think similarly, the final Marantia stage is so close to spiritual as to be almost indistinguishable, but it's not technically spiritual. Now, when you take that 571st step, you then become a true spirit, not a pure spirit, because the word pure spirit is used in connection with the spiritual attributes of the Universal Father, pure spirit and pure energy, paradise spirit and paradise manota. Because of that specialized usage, I would avoid the use of the word pure. I understand Burke gave Clyde quite a bad time on this.
No, I didn't know you had discussed
yeah.
it.
Burke gave Clyde.
Yeah.
Clyde gave Burke.
Oh.
That's a matter of opinion.
I didn't know you had discussed it, or I wouldn't ask.
No, it just happened to come up. I would say we are true spirits of a low grade
mm-hmm.
when we enter the super universe career. And, of course, that means we become such just before we leave Salvington, when we fall into the hands of the universe orientators, those seraphic ministers who are there to teach us that the spiritual estate, which is the capping climax of the long Marantia career, actually is just the beginning of the larger superuniverse and Havona career. Now we go through six stages of spiritual evolution with a projected seventh stage of the future. And I fancy that the final stage of spiritual development, we will discover, is merely the first stage of absonite or post-finite growth. A seventh stage spirit, I suspect, is a first stage absonite being. In other words, as the papers say in one place, the philosophers of the universes have come to the conclusion that there is no such thing as an end in the absolute sense of the word. Relatively, there are ends. You come to the end of this, which in turn is the beginning of something else. The end of bachelorhood is the beginning of marriage. Or something like that. Have you got any more questions that have accumulated?
I only know of one that I would like you to talk about. The 21 paradise satellites were differently eternalized, and I would like for you to explain that. Does that mean they just that they are different in nature, or does that also mean that they came into existence at different sequences?
When we deal with sequence and eternity, we're dealing with a paradox, aren't we? If the infinite spirit, like Havona, is eternal, then it follows that the eternal sun and the Isle of Paradise must be eternaler because they were there before the spirit in Havona. And it also follows that the Universal Father must be eternalist. So we now set up an absolute term on a comparative basis: eternal, eternaler, and eternalist. When it speaks of these satellites as being differently eternalized, I think you may be dealing with this paradox. And then again, you could say they were brought into being in different ways. Now, we know that the satellites of the Father are each made up of a different kind of material. The ones of the Son are uniform. I guess the ones of the Spirit are uniform too, aren't they? They're different again. So there are 15 different kinds of materialization in those three belts of paradise satellites. Now, what this means, I offer to you for speculation. I personally favor the sequential thing, but the qualitative difference you can defend just as well as you can a difference in sequence. And the minute you get into eternity, you get into some real paradoxes. For example, if the eternal Son is that absolute personality which the Father divested himself of, then the eternal Son is older than the Universal Father. And that's perfectly all right, because when you try to apply time language to eternity events, it should be quite reversible and make just as much sense one way as it does the other, because these things did not happen in time. But if we do not use time language, we're not going to think about them at all. We're just going to say, there it is, it happened, it's always been. To reason about it, we must bring this down into time and space. And I think it's perfectly proper. Had these things happened in time, then the Father would be older than the Son, and the Father and the Son would be older than the Spirit. But it didn't happen in time.
Do you think that with that line of thinking that the satellites of the Father would be internalist.
Yes. You'll notice there's a distinction. The two inner belts of satellites shed their light on Paradise and on Havona. The satellites of the spirit do not shed their light on Paradise, but only on Havona.
Is that because the shining of the orbs of the sun are too luminous for the shining of the orbs of the spirit to penetrate?
No, I think that's a symbolic statement which says these spheres illuminate. These spheres can shed light on that which they are superior to or coordinate with, but not on that which they are subordinate to. The spheres of the spirit would be coordinate with Havona, but not with Paradise. I think that's a symbolic statement. Because actually, you know, this is not illumination in the sense of an electric arc. Let me ask you a question. There came a time in the development of the universe when the Trinity issued a mandate promulgating the seven superuniverses. And I would say superuniverse history would date from the issuance of that mandate. At or about that time, I fancy the 21 Ancients of Days came into being. I would say if we thought about this as a concurrent event, it would be sound thinking. Prior to the issuance of that mandate, I'm sure no one had ever taken any action concerning the seven superuniverses. Let's set our clock back now to the day that mandate was issued. The next day, the force organizers could have begun the fabrication of space energy out in the superuniverse space level. The day before that mandate was issued, there was nothing outside of Havona except free space. Space pervaded by the unqualified absolute, full of space potency. The day after the mandate was issued, action could supervene. Before anything was organized out here in the superuniverse space level, there obviously were no local universes, were there? The first creator son had yet to receive his commission to come out and go to work. You'll recall, Michael did not arrive in the space site of Nebadon until roughly 600 billion years after the initiation of the Andromeda Nebula. A very considerable period of time elapsed between the start of this nebula and Michael's arrival. Much mass materialization had taken place. There were many stars, many inhabited worlds, and so on. They may not be pure spirits, but they're true spirits, Clyde. Now, it took a long time before Grand Fanda ever got into Havona. It took a long time before the first life was planted on the first inhabited world in all of time and space. Let's go back now to the morning of the day of the promulgation of the Trinity Mandate organizing the seven superuniverses. Let's go back in concept. What was going on Ascendington? The Paradise satellite of the Father, Son, and Spirit. all of the activities we know about were absent. There were no ascendant beings. And it was going to be a small eon before the first one got there. And yet this world, Ascendington, had been there since eternity. And I'm sure they just didn't have a for rent sign, for sale sign up there, you know, open for subdivision. I'm sure it was being used. What was going on there? Divinington presents no problems because the thought adjusters are from eternity. Divinington was swarming with thought adjusters. But no thought adjuster had ever gone forth to indwell a human being because no human being had yet evolved in outer space, as they would have referred to it, outer space. What was going on Errington? Burrington. Were solitary messengers in existence? I think not. I think not. They came into existence in the dawn of time. The near times of eternity. They're not eternal. There were no power directors, were there? If we go back to this a little. If we look at the pure concept of Havona, there were no seven master spirits. What was going on the worlds of Havona? What was going on the worlds of the seven master spirits, where the seven supreme executives now preside over the destinies of the seven super universes and their correlated segments of outer space? There were no supreme executives. Do you see how different Havona must have been in the first universe age? We don't know too much about this, do we? When we subtract the affairs of the second universe age from Havona, we realize that we have subtracted most of what they told us about Havona. All we know is that the Eternal Todays were there, the Havona natives were there, the Trinitized Secrets of Supremacy were on the worlds of the Father. But the supreme executives were not stationed on the worlds of the Spirit. Did super personalities live on the worlds of the Son? I imagine so. Let's go to the other end of the scale now. When a local universe is settled in light and life, the story changes again, doesn't it? What happens when the mansion worlds are no longer used? Nobody wakes up on the mansion world anymore in a system. They all bypass it. Wake up on Jerusalem or beyond. They tell us the finaliters take over those mansion worlds. They're the satellites of the finaliters' world. That's logical. I imagine the system nursery would function for a long time because there's still accidents on the world of time and space. Babies would still die. Children would still die. What happens when nobody wakes up on Jerusalem anymore? Everybody makes it to the satellites of Edentia, or maybe Edentia itself. The whole Marantia regime would tend to die out in a system, wouldn't it? Do you see how little by little the whole Marantia life is someday going to come to an end when a local universe is settled in light and life? Because the primary modified order of ascension consists in adjuster fusion, which transports the individual directly to the local universe capital. And such persons very nearly miss the whole Marantia life. This Marantia life is a temporary scaffolding. Design? I'd like to know that too, maybe. It says, you know, that at the present time, if you move up by the primary or secondary modified order of ascension, which means you bypass most of the lower Marantia levels, you're required to go back and serve as a teacher in the spheres that you missed. But what's going to happen when your local universe doesn't provide any more of these? Again, this is a qualifying condition which someday will be eliminated by evolutionary progression. When a whole local universe is settled in light and life, where are these imperfect worlds that you'll observe? You'll have to go outside of your local universe, and someday there won't be any place you can go. Everything's settled in light and life. Someday, I think, the whole Marantia life will vanish from the seven super universes. It's scaffolding, designed to operate during the eras of imperfection in the second universe age. When mortals are born on a world that is post-utopian, as we would call such a world, light and life roughly would be utopia. This is beyond utopia. This world looks back upon utopia as a past condition of less perfect existence. It's gone way beyond this now. What are those people going to be like? Are they going to enter the core of the finality? Will they reproduce? Will they reproduce as the atoms do on the system headquarters, which is a highly controlled reproduction designed to maintain a population? Will they remain mortal? Or will they become something like the Midsoniders? They leave the planet at the end of 1,000 years. Is the Midsonite order of existence a foreshadowing of what life on an evolutionary world is going to be like in the third universe age?
They don't have thoughts.
No? They're not indwelt by any spirit. Adams and Melchizedek. As I read this book, I say this is the story of what's going on. This is a small part of the story of what's going on here and now. It didn't used to be this way, and someday it will be quite different. But when we say it didn't used, that is going back a very large number of years. And when we say someday it won't, that is going forward, I think, a lesser number of years, but still a fabulously large number. The story we have here, I think, is considerably less than 1% of what could be told. But how would you like your answer book in 100 volumes? Each one of which is as difficult as this, or maybe more so. I personally would love it, but it's hard enough to get people to read this 2,200-page book, much less 220,000 pages. I'd love 100 volumes of the Arantia book. And even that story would be good only for here and now. It was different. It will be different. You know, there's a story I like. I imagine that some of us are going to wake up on the first mansion world, and after we recover from the kind of sleepy feeling, it'd be like coming out of a real deep sleep, you know, when you wake up and you're merely conscious, At the moment, you don't know who you are, what you are, where you are. You merely know that you are. You've had this experience, haven't you? Then little by little, it comes back. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes, I'm Bill Sadler. And you open one eye. This looks a strange room. Oh, yeah, Providence, Rhode Island. Yeah, I remember. I know where I am now. I think we're going to be a little cocky. We'll remember the Urantia book. We'll say, you know, a lot of these jokers waking up here don't know the score, but I do. I know what's ahead. I know my way around. And we might kind of throw our weight around a little bit. And the best analogy I can think of is the story of the one of our dusky brethren that was holding forth at the local chapter of the I Will Arise Society in Atlanta, Georgia. And he'd come back from North Africa, and he was full of his adventures. He had been here, he had been there. He had seen this, he had seen that. He had practically exhausted the whole gamut of human experience. And in closing, he said in a rather braggadocious tone, "In short, ladies and gentlemen, I've been everywhere. I've seen everything." And there was a little old chap in the back of the room got up and said, "I'd like to ask Brother Jones a question." Speak up there. "Has y'all ever had the delirium tremens?" "No, sir." "Well," he says, "you ain't been nowhere, you ain't seen nothing." And I have a feeling that's about what we're going to encounter. Probably the first 20 people we'll bump into will be characters that are not of record in the Urantia book. And then we'll meet one we can identify, and it'll be such a relief. What do you want to talk about this afternoon?
Your discussion here brought up three questions.
Good.
And I'm almost afraid to ask them because they'll show how little I know.
Those are the best questions many make, because those are the ones everyone else wants to know the answer
well,
to and is afraid to ask.
Everybody in here knows the answer to this, because I think they're very elementary to it. You mentioned the dawn of time.
Yes.
I'd like to know what that is and when it is.
All right. What? Let me... I did some looking on this, and I might as well give you the results of my very careful examination of this book. No.
You're going to tell your age if you're not careful.
No. Don't believe it.
I'll give you my quotes here. Page 256, paragraph 3 and 4. You can caption this, "The near times of eternity and the dawn of time." Both of these expressions are used in the book. The near times of eternity, the dawn of time. You can caption this, "The near times of eternity and the dawn of time." Both of these expressions are used in the book. The near times of eternity, the dawn of time.
That's a funny expression.
Yes.
The near times of eternity.
Page 256, paragraph 3 and 4. Following the creation of the spirits of the circuits in Havona, the conjoint actor created the solitary messengers. They have existed since the, quote, near times of eternity, unquote. Nothing is older than they are, except the circuits of Havona and Paradise. They are the first of the creations of the infinite spirit to be, quote, conscious of time, to be personalized in time and spiritualized in space, unquote. Solitary messengers appeared, quote, in the dawn of time, unquote. I submit that the two expressions are synonymous, as used in the papers. I had originally thought the near times of eternity would be the older of the two, but it evidently is not. Now, this refers to a time which is the twilight between the close of the first universe age and the beginning of the second universe age. It could be called the twilight of the first age or the dawn of the present age. It is a time in which new things are coming into being. They are it's the beginning of the age of the super universes. It is, you see, the first age had no beginning. Well, it's eternal.
My second question here was, what is the first universe age?
The first universe age, meaning May, has no origin in time. The first universe age is the age of Havona. Havona all alone. Nothing outside of Havona. If you want to say it had a beginning, then you also say the infinite spirit had a beginning. Because the infinite spirit and Havona came into existence together. Or as the papers say, in brief, the spirit testifies that since he is eternal, so also is the central and divine universe. The first universe age has an end in time. It ended when the second age began. Let me give you some notes here as to when this happened. First, let's take the unqualified concept of the first age. Page 91, paragraph 5 and paragraph 7. The third person eternalized simultaneously with Havona. Since the conjoint actor is eternal, so also is the central universe. Page 157, paragraph 2. Like Havona, the Havona natives, quote, never were created, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
My third question is, what are Havona natives?
They live on the worlds in Havona.
Mm-hmm. What are they?
They're native to those worlds.
Are they people?
They're people, yes. I think they're material people in the Havona sense of the word material, which is not as we would use the word matter. But relative to Havona, it is material.
They are spirits.
They have spiritual natures. But at least some of them are material beings. But not material as we understand the use of the word matter. Havona matter is organized differently from matter as we observe it in the super universes and in outer space. Our matter is organized on a two-way principle, positive and negative. Havona matter is organized on a three-way principle, and I don't understand that. All I can say is it's different, but it responds to gravity. In that sense, it would be comparable to our matter.
Well, are Havona natives male and female, and do they...
They're non-reproducing. They never were created. Neither do they reproduce. They're Trinity origin.
And they've always been there, and they'll always stay there.
Right. They never were created. Or, let's say this, they're as old as the infinite spirit.
They may not always stay there.
No, they can evolve. Now let's go on. Into the core of the finality, for one thing. Let's go on in our time sequence. Now, that's the unqualified concept of the first age. Now let's consider the closing of the first age. This is B. The terminus of the first age. Before the near times of eternity. Page 110, paragraph 6. When the infinite spirit had personalized, it completed the existential cycle of deity personalization. And the next deity personalizations are not coordinate, but are subordinate and subabsolute, and are the seven master spirits. These deity personalizations are not existential. They are experiential. I have the belief that whenever the seven master spirits came into being, and I think they came into being before the seven super universes ever got started, this is the first indication that the first age is drawing to a close, that a new age is being prepared for. Page 203, paragraph 2. The seven spirits of the Havona circuits are coexistent with the master spirits. Page 287, paragraph 5. They are not a part of the original Havona creation. They probably appeared as a response of the master spirits to the emerging purpose of the Supreme Being. Here's something that's in Havona. Each of these Havona circuits is pervaded by a spirit entity, not a person. And these circuit spirits have much the same relationship to the Havona natives the thought adjusters have to us, except the Havona native is permeated by this spirit, but not indwelt by a segregated presence. Now, they tell us that these circuit spirits were not a part of the original Havona creation. They came into existence later. They were created by the master spirits in response to the purpose of the Supreme Being. So this brings up something. Page 13, paragraph 3. God the Supreme is not a past eternal being. Page 641, paragraph 4. He was in existence in Havona as a spirit person before the organization of the super universes. So he too is, we must look at, as before the near times of eternity. Page 319, paragraph 10. Prior to the near times of eternity and the creation of the power directors, the force organizers had jurisdiction over the energy circuits outside of Havona. Deduction. Energy activities were taking place in the superuniverse space level long before the organization of the seven superuniverses. Now this to me, Minnie Mae, is something that is leading up to this twilight zone. This is before the near times of eternity. Certain things are happening. Now, C, the near times of eternity and the dawn of time. And here's the same quote we used before. Page 256, paragraph 3 and 4. Following the creation of the spirits of the circuits in Havona, the conjoined actor created the solitary messengers. They have existed since the near times of eternity. Nothing is older than they are except the circuits of Havona and Paradise. They are the first of the creations of the infinite spirit to be conscious of time, to be personalized in time, and spiritualized in space. Page 256, paragraph 5, solitary messengers appeared in the dawn of time. Deduction. The dawn of time is synonymous with the near times of eternity. Page 319, paragraph 10. The power directors and power centers have existed since the near times of eternity. The power directors were created by the master spirits, and with the master spirits are creators of the power centers. Page 198, paragraph 1. probably the supreme executives were trinitized with the Paradise Trinity in accordance with the specifications of the Master Spirits. Page 199, paragraph 6 and 7. The 50 reflective spirits, including Majestan, were created in the dawn of time. The Master Spirits and the Supreme Being participated in this episode. Page 222, paragraph 6. The last order of Paradise citizens was created at the time of the Trinity Mandate, which set forth the plan for the super universes. Page 287, paragraph 5. The seven spirits of the Havona circuits were discovered to be in function when the grand universe was organized. Page 203, paragraph 1. They are in liaison with the supreme executives and synchronized with the supreme being. Then, D, the beginning of super universe history. Page 209, paragraph 6. The first entry in recorded history on Paradise is the record of the trinitization of the Ancients of Days. Deduction. Anything prior to the creation of the Ancients of Days is prehistory and pertains to the near times of eternity, or to the dawn of time, or to the first universe age. Page 164, paragraph 2. Early in the materialization of the post-Havona creations, they were divided into seven segments, and the headquarters worlds of each super-universe were constructed. The Ancients of Days have ruled the super-creations from, quote, near eternity, unquote. Minnie Mae, I've searched the Blue Book, and as near as I can tell, here is the sequence. As you pass from the first age to the second age. And I've arranged it in this order because if someone appears in response to someone's request, then the requesting someone must be older. Otherwise the request couldn't be made. Now I'm a little confused about the... I have a feeling that the Master Spirits are a little older than the Supreme Being, but I'm not 100% sure about that. And it's not too important. They both of them were there before the near times of eternity, which is also the dawn of time.
Thank you very much.
There's a blurred area in there, Minnie Mae. It's a question. Is the first age ending? Is the second age beginning? Or are both happening? I think there's a gray area between these ages where it would be very difficult to say, which age are you in? You're in a transitional time. It's like an intermission between two acts of a play. Glad we had this book. I'd hate to do that from memory.
You're glad we brought
it. Ma'am?
You're glad
you know?
With references. Or to look up.
Yes, that's right. Now, I think that what inaugurated the present universe age, in fact, was the tremendous outpouring of Paradise of Owner personalities into the super universe space region. The Ancients of Days came out, their Trinity Origin Associates came out here, the Creator Sons and Creative Spirits. It was a tremendous outpouring. It was an invasion of space from the central creation. I call this the Supreme Adventure because the origin of the Supreme is involved in this. The great challenge was, from the Father to his Creator Sons, can you, by the evolutionary method, in time and space, duplicate the exquisite beauty and perfection of the central universe? There's the challenge. And these creator sons and their creative associates have accepted that challenge and have set about to duplicate God's handiwork by an entirely different method. And they'll succeed in time. Folks like us, to the contrary, notwithstanding. I see another adventure ahead. I see a day ahead when the whole seven super universes will have achieved perfection to the satisfaction of the Universal Father. His grandchildren will have duplicated his handiwork. And I see this whole thing passing through another twilight zone. And I see the beginning of the second great adventure, which I call the ultimate adventure, and the papers call it the ultimate adventure. In the last section in paper 31, they use that term, the ultimate adventure. When all the creatures of paradise, of Ona, and the perfected seven super universes will invade outer space. And this is in quest of the ultimate, and has to do with the evolutionary growth of the ultimate, and has to do with our finding God on the ultimate level as we have found him on the finite level. The same Universal Father. But now, since we are larger, we can take in more. He hasn't changed, but we have changed. First, we found him in terms of a pint's capacity to perceive. Now we have become quarks. And I think someday we'll be gallons. I see one more adventure after this. And that's when the whole master universe has achieved completion. Once more, I think there will be a mobilizing of resources, a consolidating of gains, and then the third and final adventure, the absolute adventure. And now, many may, I think we've entered upon an age at that time which is very much like the first age. The first age has no origin in time. It has an ending in time. The final age, I think, has an origin in time, but it has no ending in time. Its end is in eternity. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. That will be the understatement of this afternoon. Yes. But to me, it's a, in principle, the story, as we're involved in it, consists of three adventures. We're a part of the supreme adventure. We will participate fully in the ultimate and in the final adventure.
I have always had the feeling that, you know, many preachers say we're here ready to leave eternity.
Yeah.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, we're in eternity now.
Sure we are.
This is part of it.
I think if we mature, we are meeting eternity. Let's consider a small child. I have a neighbor. Neighbors, I should say. It takes two to produce a baby. They've got a 21-month-old little gal who's quite a dreamboat. And she's a lot of fun to watch. She lives intensely in the present moment, which is normal for a little baby. Her moods are of supreme importance to her. Frustration is the ultimate in catastrophe. She's completely unbuttressed concerning the impact, the emotional impact of present events. Now what happens? What happens as we grow? We begin to grow out of the present moment. Now sure, objective time goes right on. 60 seconds every minute, 60 minutes every hour, 24 hours in the day, and so on. But subjective time is quite different, isn't it? Objective time doesn't change at all. That's time on the outside of you. That's meeting an airplane. But your feeling for time radically changes. The present moment moves faster, doesn't it? It's gaining in velocity all the time. Am I right? As you look back in time, didn't it used to go slower?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it now going faster? Don't you sort of feel it's going to go still faster? Neither do you live as intensely in the present as this child. Your evaluation of the present is in terms of the past future. As you contemplate future conduct, a venture, let us say, you first draw on past experience, then you project it into the future. You make a moral choice, not only as to how to attain a goal, but is the goal itself desirable? And you weight this forecast with experience, so that the present ceases to be isolated as it is with a baby, and it becomes strongly affiliated with the past future. And the more you affiliate the present with the past future, the more you escape, I think, from the limitations of time. Our emergence from time is in direct proportion to our maturity here on Earth, I do believe. As Rodin put it, when he talked to Thomas and Nathaniel, we are willing to defer the more transient, immediate pleasures for more worthy and remote goals. The degree of morality, I think, is a measure of maturity. I'm not referring to morality in the conventional sense, but in discriminating between higher and lower goals. I think our escape from time starts right down here. I think it's optional. I know some people that are chronologically pretty well along, but emotionally, they're still kids. We all know them. Yeah. They live for the moment, you know, the transient pleasures of the evanescent present. And many of them are very charming people, but they're not very adult people. They're not escaping from time, at least not as fast as others.
We have to reach a balance so we feel intellectually, spiritually, and morally.
I think so, J.B.
We're doing the same thing as the previous.
Right. I think that's
on a lower level.
I think that has a lot to do with these psychic or cosmic circles of growth here on Earth. I think people get lopsided. We all know brilliant intellects that are lacking in religious feeling. And I'm sure we each of us know people who are overboard in their efforts to grow spiritually and who've neglected intellectual pursuits. There's a lack of balance there. It's the hermit who seeks the salvation of his soul but ignores the need of his brother. And to me, there should be a balance. As Jesus taught, if you've got a religion, you ought to be more effective in rendering to Caesar the things which are Caesar's. He said, what's the matter with religious people if they're less effective in the world? I had this problem come up the other day. We were trying to pick a general sales manager. And as is so often the case, I passed up all the sweet Christians and I recommended a real hard-boiled SOB. And I'm a little sick of this, because I don't think these sweet Christians in that sales force are going to be able to produce the profit results. And I'm not commissioned to pick men for the kingdom of heaven. I'm asked for and paid to recommend the promotion of a man to run that sales organization. Now I'm getting tired of recommending two-fisted SOBs and passing up all these sweet Christians. There's something wrong with them. And as Jesus said, there's something wrong with a religious person if he's less effective in the society in which he lives. And it's exactly what you say, J.B. It's got to be balanced. How did we get from the near times of eternity to a 21-month-old child? Does this give you the answer you want?
Yes, it's very good.
And Minnie Mae, I'll tell you this, until I put this together, I was puzzled. I had a kind of a feeling for this Twilight Zone, but until I actually combed the papers and got my quotes, I never felt good about it. I think we could go on, but it would be conjecture. We
well,
could
really
go on.
I didn't give it any thought until you started talking and those questions came up. And
yeah.
Suddenly had to be answered.
Sure. I think we could conjecture. There was a time, and this is a definite number of our years ago, when the 21 Ancients of Days left paradise. I think there also was a time, some later time, relatively speaking, not much later, although actually it could have been billions of years later, when the first creator son or sons were commissioned and left paradise to start the first local university. There was a time, and I think this is a finite number of years, we could write the number, we knew it, when life was planted on the very first evolutionary world in all time and space. That would be the oldest inhabited world, if it's still in existence, if it survived the astronomical catastrophes of its region. There was a time when the very first mortal died and survived. A time when the first thought adjuster came to indwell the first evolutionary being. And can you imagine how breathless people must have been when they watched these unprecedented things? We were talking last evening. We tried to conjecture four Havona natives sitting around. The Ancients of Days have gone out. The pipeline has it all over Havona. Everybody knows what's going on. And these Havona natives are trying to consider, what are these so-called mortals going to be like? In the first place, the word mortal itself is paradoxical. What is death? No Havona native has ever died. And this word imperfect that they're telling us about, imperfect, this means not natural. It's natural to be perfect. This means this is a contradiction. This is almost like saying these beings are not real. Because if you're real, well, this is natural, and it's natural to be perfect. These folks have never known anything except flawless perfection. Do you see how impossible it is for these four Havona natives, or 400, or 4 million of them, to sit down and conceive of an imperfect, evolutionary, finite, mortal creature? And I suspect when Grand Fanda got to Havona, he was a focal point of great curiosity. And even he, I don't think, could explain to a Havona native his background. Neither can we, sitting around this table, conceive of the natures of the creatures of outer space, who are not going to be like Havona natives, and they're not going to be like us. They're post-finite beings. We tried to reason this way. Well, if they start on the absinthe level, they start a lot better than we do. I think we will achieve the absinthe level by that time, as seven-stage spirit beings. And that will be the level they'll start on, but we will have a hard time explaining to them what it's like to grow up to the level on which they're born. It's kind of like a mighty messenger trying to explain to a divine counselor what it's like to be sub-perfect. Now, a mighty messenger, being Trinity embraced, is a coordinate of a divine counselor. But he is Trinity origin. He never was anything except a flawlessly perfect being. Now the mighty messenger has become flawlessly perfect in terms of the present universe age because of the Trinity embrace. But the mighty messenger understands all of the antecedents to the near levels of such perfection. We can now stop talking about Wilma. We'll get right on the Urantia book.
We haven't seen Wilma in 2 weeks.
We've been talking about nothing but you, Wilma, all afternoon.
Been talking about angels in heaven.
Yes.
Mighty messenger.
Why don't we have a stretch?
Mighty messenger, that's better.
When's coffee coming up?
Let's
do that. Yeah, let's turn the machine.
Who wrote it?
He was a fella. He was a reporter for the New York Times. I think he was in diplomatic service. And if I recall distinctly, he had a connection with the FBI one time, and he...
It's a nice background.
He knows the situation. He don't quote dates and figures, he quotes personality. Mm-hmm. In regard to this invasion of Cuba, and why it shouldn't have happened, and the State Department knew all about it, but they wouldn't listen. He goes on to tell about these orders issued in the State Department to come through, that there's no signature. Nobody will sign their name. Nobody will retain any responsibility for it. See? Well, that's a historical. If you had a department and there was a mandate issued, wouldn't you want to know someplace you could put your finger on to go back to it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, am I talking out of turn?
No.
Well, we have a document up there.
He
was talking about Caroline. He had to be quite
a
beautiful, intelligent child.
But
he says, I'll bet her dad
doesn't
know her anymore.
I particularly became deteriorated. And what we're doing now, I wasn't for Kennedy. The first 6 months of his office, I don't think he had his feet on the ground. He didn't have his cabinet. He didn't get the best advice. But I thought from then on, conscientiously, from my observance, that he was a dedicated man to his job. He's trying to do the best he could with the ability. But now, here in the last week, when
air.
I see that we're going to have a 3 billion
we're on the air.
Deficiency and a budget, I don't know.
Maybe he wants Canada to know this.
If we don't, we're going to have more inflation.
Do you want to ask your question again?
Yes, sir. I had made an observation.
The question asked is, many people feel that immaturity, I presume you mean of a moral, ethical, spiritual nature, is at the root of most of our world troubles. And the question is, what is the part to be played for the Blue Book in the correction or amelioration of this problem? And that's a heck of a good question, to which I do not know the answer. But I'll share my speculation with you. I don't see any immediate influence of the Blue Book on the problems of this world. Because, in biblical terms, we be too few. The book be too young. The there are, I think the book is destined to begin to have a significant influence in the affairs of men roughly three generations after its appearance here. This, of course, has given rise to two schools of thought as to what to do about this book. I'll come back to your question, but I'd like to discuss intermediates first. There is the school of thought which says, since the book is for the future, there's not much to do about it in the present. Relax. Why are you perspiring? There's another school of thought which says, let's get a soapbox, hire a hall, run advertisements, get on the radio and whatnot. Why are you people doing nothing? I frankly don't share either of these views. I think one is frenzied and the other is using caution as an excuse for laziness. Now, I favor a course of action in between these two. I've got an engineering friend in Darien, and one Saturday morning, I guess it was Sunday morning, over breakfast, which lasted interminably, he and his wife and I were talking, and Sandy said, let's compute the spread of this book mathematically. Well, he said, give me a basis to start on. Well, I said, Sandy, I'll pick this right off the chandelier, but I think it's reasonable. Let's say, just to keep the numbers easy, that there are now, or will be in a year or two, or were a year or two ago, 1,000 people that are really interested in this book. And that number will fit either the present or the recent past or the near future. And let's say that of this 1,000 people, 100, 10%, have the willingness and the ability to function in a missionary capacity, a sales capacity. 10% will be active in spreading this book, 1 out of 10. And let's assume that these missionaries, these salesmen, are successful in interesting one person per annum. And in turn, of these 100 new recruits, 10 will be missionaries, and 90 will enjoy the book in a more passive way. So Sandy set up a formula, and this can be solved. It's nothing more than compound interest, compounding at the rate of 10% per annum. And Sandy said, when would you say the book will really be significant? I said, when there are 1 million Urantians and 100,000 salesmen. And the solution to the equation is 70 years.
Seven.
70 years. Yes.
Now, you're just speaking in the United States. It's not ecumenical.
That's right. And we got a Frenchman, though.
Yeah.
There's a Frenchman who is a good promoter, an honest promoter. Now, in order for this book to be where it needs to be and to do what it may be called upon to do, there's got to be some activity, sustained activity, year by year, year by year, for at least three generations. I would have projected roughly 100 years from publication. So Sandy comes out, there's a 20-year difference. We've had it 5 years roughly, and he figures 70 instead of 95. That, to me, these are numbers of approximately the same magnitude. So I don't think my supposition was too bad. If we got 1,000 people, of whom 10% will be active, and in turn, of our recruits, 10% will be active. A 70-year forecast is not a bad one. I think when this book has 1 million people interested in it and 100,000 people propagating it, people will know about this book. Call it 2 million if you want to. Call it 500,000 if you want to. Some such number is reasonable. Now, question, what's it going to do? I think this book is designed to appear on Earth as a normal part of the evolution of religion on this planet. This looks like an emergency transaction. I'm not so sure that it's as much of an emergency deal as we might think it is. It's an unusual thing, but if we knew enough stories of isolated worlds that have gone through the ups and downs that our world has gone through, if we knew about 10,000 of these worlds, we only know about two, ourselves and life on a neighboring planet, we might discover this is not such an uncommon thing. They've done this before. They'll do it again. I think this is designed to function as the foundation, the theological foundation for the Brotherhood of Man, a common meeting place for all religions. I think it is designed to liberate the life and teachings of Jesus from its incarceration in Western Christendom. The white man has captured Jesus of Nazareth and has taken his gospel and made it over in his own image, and therefore has made it less acceptable to every other race and every other culture on the face of the earth. To the extent that we have occidentalized Jesus, we have denied all other men access to Jesus. I regard Buddhism as just as fine a vehicle for Jesus' teaching as Judaism. Judaism provided a vehicle for the teachings of Jesus. Buddhism would provide just as fine a vehicle for the teachings of Jesus. Jesus' teachings can ride piggyback on any religion. Only we captured it. That, I think, is the function of the book. Now, as to what lies between now and 100 years from now, or 70, or 90, or 120, after all, none of us will be here then, I don't know. I think our unseen friends are intensely practical. I think our unseen friends are perfectly willing to let the human race learn about war in the only way that the human race seems to be able to learn about war, and that's to have at it until we finally make up our minds it's unprofitable. With the dawn of atomic weapons, I think for the first time, man has begun to realize that major war really won't pay off.